An unmanned SpaceX rocket that blasted off on Saturday has now docked at the International Space Station, marking a key milestone for Elon Musk's company. NASA awarded SpaceX and Boeing $6.8 billion to build competing rocket and capsule systems. One of those organizations will eventually have bragging rights as the first private company to launch humans into space on its own rocket.
Big U.S. grocers were spooked on Friday after a report that Amazon plans to open dozens of grocery stores in several major U.S. cities. The Wall Street Journal citing sources said Amazon plans to open its first grocery store in L.A. as early as the end of this year and has signed leases for at least two other locations. Amazon is also exploring buying some regional grocery chains to widen the new supermarket brand.
Fancy a day trip to Europe's floating city? It'll soon cost you an extra €3. Venice Council has just voted to impose the entrance fee to help pay for the upkeep of the UNESCO World Heritage Site. 25 million tourists pour into the Italian city each year, but the problem is that around 14 million of them only come for the day. They don't stay the night and often bring picnics, bringing no income to local businesses.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's March 4th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in again this morning for another edition of The Opening Bell. We're getting underway with another business week and another business day, and we put together a good broadcast to get you going this morning. It, of course, is a CEO Spotlight Monday. This morning, we're happy to have Tracy Elliott with us from the Anti-Cruelty Society in Chicago. He's the new president of the Anti-Cruelty Society. We're going to be bringing in Tracy momentarily to tell you a little bit more about what it takes to run a nonprofit like the Anti-Cruelty Society, a 120-year-old nonprofit. A little bit later in the program, we're going to have a conversation about the latest auto news, specifically Detroit gets a brand new auto plant. There's some renewed investment, but also a few layoffs, including some that have impacted the Chicago area. We'll get to that at about 5:40 this morning. Dale Buss will be with us from Michigan. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk with futures pointing toward opening gains a little bit later on Wall Street. Dow futures are up 60 points this morning, nearly a quarter of a percent. Same story over at the NASDAQ and S&P. In Europe, markets are generally in the green as well. In London, up nearly a half a percent, just a fraction in Germany, and nearly a half a percent in France. And in Asia, markets are firmly in the green, with the Nikkei up nearly a percent, and the Shanghai up nearly a percent as well. The Hang Seng up about a half a percent. Oil is trading at $56.31 a barrel in the U.S., at 50, up 51 cents, nearly a percent. A couple of headlines this morning. There is another report that the U.S. and China may be close to a deal that would lift most sanctions on Chinese goods. Wall Street Journal reports an agreement would lower tariffs on tariffs China has imposed on U.S. imports. Journal reported yesterday the negotiators in the final stages of putting the deal together. But we've been hearing this in various forms for the last week or so. We'll wait to see how that story moves along. New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer is hoping Amazon will change its mind and open its second headquarters in New York. After all, the high-tech giant walked away from a deal in Long Island City 2 weeks ago. Schumer wants the headquarters in Queens. And after pushing back from some local lawmakers who were not in favor of the tax break Amazon was set to get, they pulled out. Governor Andrew Cuomo has reached out to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos this past week, hoping to resurrect the deal. Everyone across the country watching this to see how a corporate client deals with the government, in this case, New York State, but it really could be any state. We begin front and center this morning with what it takes to run a 120-year-old nonprofit. The new president of Chicago's Anti-Cruelty Society, Tracy Elliott, is with us this morning for a conversation about the business of protecting and caring for animals. Tracy, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And welcome to Chicago as well. You're pretty new.
I appreciate that. Very new.
Yeah, you just moved
about a week.
About a week. So you're still sort of getting your footing, aren't you?
I am indeed. I took the wrong train home last night. I took a free trip to Downers Grove.
Right. Well, you're the new president of Anti-Cruelty Society. Talk to us a little bit about why you've accepted this position and what is in store for you.
Well, this organization has an amazing history and certainly an amazing current scope. And the opportunity to then shape its future was just an opportunity that really would be the capstone to my career. I studied the organization when I got into the animal welfare field only 4 years ago and running the Asheville Humane Society. I asked the ASPCA, the senior vice president, who kind of took me under her wing, what are some organizations that I should take a very close look at? And she gave me a pretty small list, and one of them was the Anti-Cruelty Society. And so I was very aware of it. I knew the previous president very well. And she helped me on a number of issues that we were working on. So when the opportunity arose, it just became obvious that this was the right move to make.
What does the president of the organization do? Are you in charge of everything? Is that going to be your
everything
job?
And nothing? Yeah. yes, it's really a chief executive officer position in the organization. So I just make sure things are moving forward. I look at my role is supporting my staff. They're there for the animals. I'm there for them to clear obstacles out of their way so they can achieve excellence in everything they do. And also to help them create a vision. We are going to look at where both this field is going, what our constituents need here in Chicago, and together, staff, board, volunteers, donors, we will create the vision for the next step in this amazing 120-year journey that this organization has been on.
And talk to us a little bit about that. It's rare that you see organizations have so much history.
Indeed.
And there are a few, the big ones.
Right.
This would be one of them.
Indeed it is. In fact, it's rather amazing if you think of the development of this field. Most organizations that I'm aware of that do this around the country, you know, 30, 35, 40 years when people's awareness of the needs of animals and that animals had the right to a life worth living is still a fairly new concept. So the fact that there were people in Chicago 120 years ago, women, by the way, by and large, who had this vision that animals should and could be treated better, and started an organization probably before they could sign contracts, certainly before they could vote. They probably had no ability to actually do the normal things that have to be done to start a business, but that didn't stop them. They founded this organization, and it's been on that journey for 120 years.
I think it's a history that I don't think a lot of people know about. I think a lot of people are familiar with Anti-Cruelty Society,
sure.
But that history, especially how it started, is
right.
Not one that a lot of people know.
Right. It's very connected to you know, one of the most well-known people in Chicago history, Jane Addams, and mm-hmm. the kind of movement that she generated with Hull House and the idea that society has an obligation to take care of, in her case, children and women who did not have other forms of care. And about that same time, that idea was translated to caring for animals. I think originally it was mostly the horses that were used on the streets of Chicago by policemen and carriages and things like that to make sure they were cared for. There was water for them. They weren't abused. They had good lives after they were retired. Usually that didn't happen. And then it moved on, of course, to companion animals and all the animals that we take in now. We're an open admission shelter and a private open admission shelter, and that is extremely rare. The organization I ran in Asheville was open admission, but that part of our business, we were the municipal shelter. We ran the shelter for the county in that area. We also had a private adoption facility. But to make a commitment to be an open admission shelter when you have no contractual requirements or legal requirements to do so is an amazing thing to do. It's one of the reasons I respect this organization so much. It would be much easier to say we'll pick and choose who we can take in. But that's not what this organization has chosen to do. So they've taken the harder route and the route that saves more animals and saves much more, deals with much more difficulty in terms of saving animals, medical cases, behavioral cases, cruelty and neglect cases, and those animals are rehabilitated and saved and find new loving homes.
What are the challenges to doing that? Not only from just a organizational effort, but from a financial effort as
yep.
well.
Well, having the resources to give the animals what they need. And the most expensive aspect of that is medical. Any open admission shelter is going to get animals that are, have extreme medical issues, but they can be rehabilitated. That's a very expensive proposition. Oftentimes, it is a lifetime commitment. In other words, it's an animal that's going to need some kind of care for the rest of its life. And then the other thing that people don't think about is behavioral rehabilitation. It requires very well-trained, often certified individuals, professionals, to rehabilitate, particularly a dog. There's also cat rehabilitation, but mostly dogs who are fearful, who are aggressive, who have shut down because of the abuse or neglect that they've faced, or just aren't socialized. They haven't had human contact. That also is an expensive proposition, and it takes time. The other thing is time. Time in the shelter. Every day an animal's in our shelter, there's a particular cost to caring for that animal. You know, food and sanitization of their living quarters, things like that. Getting walks, getting cared for. So if we took easy cases, they'd be in and out fast. We don't do that. We take the hard cases, so they spend more time with us, and as a result of that, there's more expense.
More than just volunteers caring for the daily activities of the pets that are there, the animals that are there, you have to have a professional staff of people who know how to do those various jobs.
Yes, you do. So you don't just go in an animal shelter and hose down the cage. There is a very specific process and specific products that you have to use to make sure that that cage is sanitized. And because in just like a hospital, right, that's where all the sick people are.
Yeah.
Disease can spread very easily if proper sanitization is not taken care of. And then, so that's actually a process that someone has to learn and be trained and be monitored. And then, of course, yes, we need medical specialists, both vets and vet techs, and we need behaviorists to modify the behavior of the animals.
Have you been able to meet with a lot of your staff yet? What do you see as any challenges there or things that you're already on your radar screen with staff and budget?
Well, I'm just beginning to dig into all of that. And what I've seen so far is a staff that's incredibly dedicated to their job and to their jobs, to their work, to the animals. I'm sort of obsessive compulsive about culture and making sure that as a workplace culture of transparency and access to decisions. And so I'm getting my feet wet as to what already exists in terms of how the staff feels about their ability to help guide and direct the future of the organization. So that will be job number one, is to discover that.
You mentioned you come from Asheville, where you were the executive director of the Asheville, North Carolina Humane Society.
Right.
But your background includes other not-in-profit work. You were even a banker for a time when you lived in South
Bend. I was a banker,
Bend.
Yes. I reformed, but yes, yeah. I was a banker.
How do all of these things prepare you for the job you're now taking on?
Well, I tell you, banking was a phenomenal business education. And I was in a great organization that was small enough that I had lots of important things to do, but large enough that I got to really deal with complex business problems. So, I was there 13 years, and I consider that to have given me an MBA and PhD and any other business degree. But I always had an interest eventually in running not-for-profit organizations. So I enrolled at Notre Dame in their not-for-profit management master's program while I was at the bank. And the bank paid for it, which was great. For the most part, it's an MBA program, but it focuses on the particular problems that not-for-profits have. So I was developing both a for-profit business experience, and it was phenomenal, as well as being educated in the specific aspects of not-for-profit management. So that's what the banking thing was all about, and they gave me lots of fun things to do. What I discovered there was an ability to fix and solve problems. So my birthday happens to be 9/11, and on that 9/11 was my 41st birthday, and I'd been thinking for a long time, how am I going to make this exit and entrance into something that means something to me, something that I'm passionate about? And I delayed and delayed and delayed. Well, 1 year after the 9/11, I was CEO of an AIDS organization, because that incident really got me moving and said, it's time to do this. If you're going to do it, mm-hmm. it's time to do it. So that's what prompted me to get into the HIV/AIDS world, which I had been a volunteer for and was very passionate about. And the organization that I became CEO of was failing. It was on the brink of bankruptcy and closure. And that's kind of what I did at the bank, is I fixed programs and departments that weren't doing well. So I was able to meet that challenge, go to that organization, and learn a lot about what it means to run a not-for-profit. Most importantly, that the staff is the spine and the heart and the brain, and they need to be treated well. They need to be respected. Their opinions need to matter, and it needs to be a joint effort. There is, it's not a democracy, but it also, a not-for-profit CEO is not a dictator and can't be. There has to be a lot of input from staff about the direction of the organization. And that's how we were able to pull that organization basically out of its close to bankruptcy situation and make it thrive.
You describe a process too that I think you would probably pull from as you arrive here. And that is, you know, when you determine what is next for the organization,
right?
It's sort of a democratic thing, right? You'll talk to the people that work there.
Absolutely.
And enlist the community as well.
You bet. Any vision that you're trying to actually realize is not going to be done by one person or even a senior management team. I have four other really bright, talented individuals who are vice presidents of the organization, but the five of us can't move the organization forward without input from everybody who has to implement the changes that you're trying to bring about. So that's the process that I've used, and it's always been very successful. At the end of the day, though, there does have to be someone who puts it all together in a vision that people can rally around and feel passionate about. And after gathering all that data and opinions and the discussions that we'll have, you know, then it's my job to put it into an actionable plan.
You're the steward of a 120-year-old organization. Have you even thought about what might be next in the next 120 years along those lines?
I have. Where animal welfare is going around the country, especially in the north, is the sheltering business is shrinking. Thanks to spay-neuter efforts, thanks to public education, thanks to just a better attitude about animals, the number of animals coming into shelters all around the country, but as I said, particularly in the north, particularly in urban areas, is shrinking. That will never go away. We will always take care of those strays and surrenders and so forth, but we've got to figure out what's the next, you know, line of business that we can morph into that's going to save more animals. And for most organizations, when they're moving in that direction, certainly this is the direction we took in Asheville, it's taking all those services that we have provided to these strays and surrenders for 120 years and moving those deeper into the community. Vet care in particular is becoming very, very expensive. And if you are on a limited income or you're in a challenging situation, that can often be daunting and impossible for you to properly care for an animal that you love. So we cannot assume that folks in challenging situations don't love their animals as much as or more than we do. But a lot of organizations are recognizing that our next step should be to get in those communities and help those folks make sure that they can care for their animals who they love very much. So we're already there. We're doing a lot of that. But I see that as just where the field is going. And I'm excited to look at how to expand those opportunities here in Chicago.
It feels to me like animal welfare has taken a gigantic leap forward, especially over the last 5 years. Here in Cook County with the puppy mill law.
Yes.
In Illinois, no longer being able to chain your dog outside all the time. It feels like we have taken a gigantic leap forward. Would you agree with that? Or
I would, but it's state by state and territory by territory. There are states that have none of those laws. There are localities that do not have those laws. Illinois is way ahead of the curve on those kinds of issues. So I'm very glad about that, but we have a lot of work to do around the country to enact those kinds of laws. And there are more things that need to be done even here in Illinois to protect animals. But I would agree with you. People and legislators are beginning to move in the right direction and see that this is an important matter to deal with.
There's a lot of issues, too, with agriculture and animals. And
yes.
Coming from North Carolina, from Asheville, you probably have dealt with some of those firsthand as well.
Yes. Well, I grew up in the country in Indiana when, you know, the cows were out in the field and had great lives, and the pigs were, you know, running not entirely free, but you go out there and play with them, and the chickens were running around the yard. That's my ideal of what a farm looked like. Mm-hmm. But in both Indiana and North Carolina, that's generally not the case anymore. Industrial agriculture is a huge problem in terms of animal cruelty, and we need to be addressing that. And I don't know exactly what role the Anti-Cruelty Society might play in that fight, but we'll certainly be looking at it.
Who are the paws behind the person with you?
Oh, yes.
You're a dog person, a cat person?
Well, I love all, but I'm pretty allergic to cats. So if I go play with kitties, I have to take a Benadryl. Doesn't mean I don't do it. I go into the cat room and then I come back. But I have two rescue dogs, one from Atlanta when I lived there and ran Aid Atlanta. His name is Ricky. He was supposed to be a rat terrier, but he's not. He's more like an Italian greyhound, and he's a special boy with special needs, but he's a great guy. And he's traveled with me every place I've gone. And then just about a year ago in Asheville, after office fostering a very, very sick and injured Chihuahua for several months, and then he went to foster for several months with one of our staff members, one of my dogs had passed away. So I had a place in the family, and they asked me, they said, you're the only person we would feel comfortable adopting this guy to because he already knows you and everything. So I did take him. He's a little 10-year-old Chihuahua with a big attitude. But a great little guy, and he survived so much. He has been poked and prodded, and he's tough. He came in very rough state, and in fact, it's a really, really good story about an open admission shelter, which we were in Asheville. You know, we took this little guy, he's a stray on the street, and you know, we knew it was going to be a challenge. I added up all of the care that was provided for him over the about 8 months that we had possession before I before I adopted him, and it was about $5,000. Luckily, we had those resources in Asheville, and we had a special donor down there who gave just for senior dogs, and so we had a fund for that. And of course, she became a good friend of his too because she saved his life. But he's just a great example of what shelters can do when they are. They have the support of the community to save lives, and I know we do here too.
Yeah, and also the role of fostering.
Fostering.
Even at Anti-Cruelty Society, the number of fosters there and the work you do with fostering is pretty significant.
Yes. I think the impact of fostering is probably not generally understood. I certainly didn't understand. I thought it was just a chance to get an animal out of the shelter. It is that. But fosters do a couple of things that are critical. One is they increase the capacity of your organization. So in Asheville, we had as many animals in foster oftentimes as we had in shelter, and I'm sure that's the case here as well. And so that doubles your capacity for care. The other thing, of course, is that they take animals like Denver who need a special foster. They need a person who understands how to administer medications or give them a quiet atmosphere, or in some cases it's a behavioral situation. It's a person who knows how to deal with a dog that gets ramped up easily or is unsocialized. And so that's a rehabilitation tool, and they save lives.
What does the role of social media, how does the social media help what you do these days? As somebody who follows dozens of accounts on Instagram
right.
and Facebook,
right.
it feels like people not only are supportive but giving as well.
They are.
There's always a GoFundMe page helping a dog or
right.
someone's raising money to donate to anti-cruelty.
Right.
So how big is social media to what you guys are doing nowadays?
It's critically important. Our business is a business of stories. We have tremendous stories. Every animal from the moment they come into our care until they leave and often afterwards is a great story. And they're all individual stories. So let's just face it. People love animal stories.
Yeah.
And they love happy endings. And we provide both of those things. So our business is perfectly suited for social media. You know, some of the largest followed pages on Facebook are like the Dodo and
yeah.
The one with the pig, I can't remember, but these two guys who adopted a pig and now...
And they have the turkey like in their living room as well.
Two, yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, yeah. We know this, right?
Right.
They have like millions of followers.
Yeah.
So it's a great advantage to be able to tell those stories and have people literally engage with you. That's the great thing, is they're engaging in your work. And it makes you feel good just to know those things are happening. So... social media is a critical way to tell our story and to get people engaged.
It's a wonderful meeting you. Again, welcome to Chicago.
And thank
please
you.
Come back and join us anytime you want.
I appreciate it. Thanks All for right. having me.
Tracy Elliott is the Anti-Cruelty Society's new president. You can find more at anticruelty.org and follow them on Twitter at anticruelty. And we're going to continue our conversation with Tracy after the bell this morning and post that bonus contact with the podcast of the opening bell a little bit later on this morning at WGNradio.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for ringing in the new business day with us here this morning. We turn our focus now to the automotive industry and news over the last week or so that nearly 1,400 auto workers in Belvidere will lose their job as the result of weak demand in China for Jeep Cherokee. Fiat Chrysler announcing it's eliminating the third shift at the Belvidere plant starting in May. And at the same time, Fiat Chrysler announcing plans to build a new plant for big Jeeps in Detroit. Retrofitting old facilities there. We have lots to talk about in the world of autos this morning. And Dale Buss joins us from Michigan this morning, contributor at Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine, and others. Dale, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks, Steve.
So what Fiat Chrysler giveth, it taketh away. It's the tale of two cities here, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I've been to the Belvidere plant many times over the years, and it's an unfortunate situation there. The plant, I mean, I think back in the day it made the Neon, the little car that was such a hit for a while, and more lately I think it made the Dodge Dart, which didn't last very long. Yes, problems in China, you know, reverberate throughout the auto industry, but I guess what is interesting about what's happening in Belvidere is a reflection of what I think is kind of an inflection point here in the industry these days, where a lot of the trends that folks have been pointing to for the last 2, 3, 5 years are finally coming to fruition in a lot of different and interesting ways. Now, you mentioned the investment in Detroit by Fiat Chrysler. What's going on there is, interestingly, Fiat Chrysler has become, you know, perhaps the most robust of the traditional Detroit 3 automakers, because it just keeps selling Ram pickup trucks and Jeep SUVs in so many new forms. And in fact, what's going on in Detroit, while Fiat Chrysler is laying some people off in Belvidere, reflecting what's going on in China, what's happening in the U.S. is just continuing boom in sales of these trucks and SUVs by Fiat Chrysler. And so they're investing some billions of dollars in renovating an old engine plant in Detroit. And they're going to make another big Jeep model in the coming months. And really what Fiat Chrysler has done is placed all its chips on Jeep and Ram, and isn't even making cars anymore. And yet it's, with that bet, as long as the U.S. economy stays healthy, people keep buying big vehicles, you know, it's looking pretty good as an overall entity these days.
Yeah, and then buying the trends I think you're talking about there, not only just this continuing SUV truck trend, but it's also the plug-in hybrid models as well, isn't it?
Yeah, now that's, again, that's something that's where we're seeing some really interesting new wrinkles in the development of plug-in hybrids and electric cars overall. Of course, you know well, every automaker has some kind of electric model either out there or in development, or in some cases, you know, a handful. The American public is just not ready to buy these vehicles en masse yet. They need to keep getting better. The battery capabilities need to keep improving. The price needs to come down. But in that arena, one of the most interesting developments, again, that illustrates what's going on in the industry, is there's a startup in the Detroit area called Rivian, R-I-V-I-A-N, and they have been kind of quietly marshaling their forces over the last few years. And at the LA Auto Show, they made a big splash with an electric truck and an SUV prototype, and kind of turning the notion of these tiny little roundabouts on its head with a very strong sort of design, a very capable vehicle. And it turns out that Amazon thinks so much of what Rivian is developing that it has invested $700 million in this startup, which will perhaps, Amazon might be the first customer and buy thousands of these vehicles to help with deliveries. And so GM also might invest in Rivian. And this is an example of how some of these trends that have been kind of slowly developing the auto industry are now accelerating and getting to a launching point. I mean, an electric pickup truck is really an interesting development, and it's been occurring without all the hype that Tesla has generated for its cars.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely right, and we'll be watching that one very closely here in Illinois because they've also bought a plant down in the former plant in Normal.
That's right. They've got the old Mitsubishi facility. And so what's, these new relationships taking place in the industry also include what's happening between Amazon and General Motors, where just last week it was announced that one of GM's top manufacturing executives, a woman named Alicia Bowler Davis, is defecting to Amazon. And people are wondering what that's all about. Is Amazon planning on getting into the business of building cars just like they're trying to take over every other business? Well, that's not likely, but it is interesting to see what somebody with that kind of manufacturing experience and big three pedigree might do at Amazon. So a really interesting development there.
What's happening over at Ford? Some news that they might be working with VW on autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, Ford is interesting, and I think we may have talked about this before, but it's all really at Ford right now. It's all about Jim Hackett, the CEO. He continues to be a mystery, even to many of his own people. His management style is very different. He's not moving as quickly in many areas as a lot of investors would like. So he's a little bit of a mystery, and yet Bill Ford, who hired him, who's the executive chairman and the family presence at the company, has stood by Hackett. He was an interesting hire a couple of years ago. And so there's a sense of some other shoe is going to drop here, and we just don't know what it's going to be. Because Hackett says, be patient, I'm a different kind of guy, you're going to see what I'm going to do. Well, some people are running out of patience. But meantime, the most interesting current development at Ford is they have launched a new marketing campaign for the new Ranger midsize pickup truck, which is a long-awaited re-entry by Ford into that segment. And they're doing it with a bunch of commercials that try to carve out the new Ranger as a vehicle for outdoors people. And it'll be really interesting to see if Ford can get back into this segment that it abandoned several years ago, where General Motors, a few years earlier came back with the GMC Canyon and the Chevrolet Colorado. And in this pickup crazy market, it's just a great place to be. Can Ford get back in there effectively?
You mentioned earlier Tesla. It seems like every week there's a new wrinkle in the Tesla story. I know Elon Musk is pretty happy this morning because his capsule is docked with the International Space Station for SpaceX, but Tesla's still having some struggles, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And Elon Musk is all about promises, right? You mentioned SpaceX, and of course he has famously said he wants to die on Mars, so I guess that's moving forward. But back here on Earth, Tesla continues to struggle to get the price of its Model 3 down to that range of around $35,000, which would make it truly a mainstream vehicle. And that's something that Elon Musk promised several years ago that was his goal. It's just that he's doing some really interesting things to try to get down to that price point. And one of the most amazing was announced last week where the company has said it is going to get rid of all of its stores. So in the near future, you're only going to be able to buy Tesla online. All these sort of pop-up showrooms that Tesla has in fancy shopping malls and other locations around big cities around the country, where people familiarize themselves with the brand and with the vehicles and kind of get excited about them, those are going to go. And with the express goal by Tesla of taking some costs out of its structure so that it can get that price of the Model 3 closer to a mainstream level. And of course, Elon Musk is still in trouble with his tweets, and he kind of thumbs his nose at the Securities and Exchange Commission every once in a while. So now they're now looking at him again to see if he has violated terms of his agreement with them from last year. So, you know, the Elon Musk show continues to be a three-ring circus, and that's not going to change.
Yeah, and I don't know, how does do a lot of people buy brand new $35,000 cars without test driving them first?
Well, that is a problem, and Tesla, you know, will have ways for you to get sort of, you know, maybe online appointments with a test drive, that sort of thing. But it's a real difficulty, and he spent years and many millions of dollars fighting the traditional dealership franchise structure that the auto industry, the traditional auto industry, has, and finally, you know, has been able to have his own stores without the requirement to go through dealers. And now, because of this latest development, he's saying, forget that. We'll just do it online. So it'll be interesting. I mean, the brand continues to be such a fascinating draw for people. The vehicles are mostly, you know, pretty high quality, and, you know, the future belongs to Tesla, I guess, but it's just a question of how far out that future is.
All right. Dale, good talking with you as always. Good stuff on autos. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Dale Buss, a contributor at Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine, and others, on some auto news this morning.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a positive open later on Wall Street. Dow futures are up 72 points, nearly a quarter of a percent, nearly a quarter percent higher on the S&P as well. And NASDAQ futures up by nearly a half a percent. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, the last big agricultural organization meeting of the winter season came to an end over the weekend, Commodity Classic in Orlando, Florida. But a couple of mentions this morning on people who were honored at the event. A Minnesota farm family's four-generation conservation initiative got national attention at the Commodity Classic. The National Corn Growers Association presented Rick Schlichting's Schlichting Farms of Rice, Minnesota, with its 2019 Good Stewardship recognition. And then from Illinois, Ron Moore, soybean farmer from Roseville, Illinois, and longtime state and national soybean industry leader, was honored by the American Soybean Association during the group's banquet held during Commodity Classic. He received the American Soybean Association's Distinguished Leadership Award. And I've known him for many years, and he's certainly deserving of that award. Meanwhile, as we look at markets to start this weekend, we ended the last week with wheat posting its steepest weekly decline in half a year, and then cattle futures that hit new contract highs Friday, supported by worries about cold weather. Well, we'll see if those worries came to reality when the markets trade today. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Monday, March the 4th. Construction spending figures for December are due today. Building industry analysts forecast a 0.6% increase over November. Construction spending report at mid-morning. Also today, Salesforce earnings. Looking ahead to the rest of the week, tomorrow earnings from Target, Kohl's, and Ross stores. Also, U.S. ISM non-manufacturing index. On Wednesday, Dollar Tree, Abercrombie & Fitch, the Fed Beige book is due out. We'll get earnings from Kroger Thursday, along with H&R Block and Costco. And then on Friday, it's the jobs report. So a lot happening this week in economic news.